The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Can you help me, please? I've had a problem with my health for years and I can't get to the bottom of it. The doctors have run out of ideas.
I'd love to help. My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session.
Right, can you book me in, please?
For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
If only I'd found out about you sooner, it would have made so much difference.
Hello and welcome to the Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, your host for the show, and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, which is a cancer charity focusing on integrative medicine. Integrative medicine means drawing on the benefits of both conventional and complementary and alternative medicine approaches to provide the most comprehensive strategies. In the best circumstances, it means the judicious combining of conventional and natural medicine to exploit synergies that are increasingly being discovered, which can produce surprising results that are greater than the sum of the parts. You may remember a few weeks back I was speaking to Dr. Joseph Cullen in Canada, who was achieving a doubling in life expectancy in pancreatic cancer by simply adding vitamin C to standard treatment. My guest today has been involved in a Danish trial with similarly spectacular results from combining an extract of vitamin E with standard drug treatment for advanced ovarian cancer. I'm speaking to Dr. Caroline Brenner-Thompson over Skype in Denmark. Hi, Caroline. Thanks very much indeed for coming on the Yes to Life show.
Hi.
The reason I want to talk to you today is because of the recent trial you ran using an extract of vitamin E with advanced ovarian cancer. So I was really struck by the results. I guess that you were hopeful at the outset that there were going to be some good results, but were they in fact a surprise to you?
Yes, they were. We did not think that the survival data would be as promising as they were. So yes, that was very surprising to us. So that we could actually improve the survival in these chemo-refractory ovarian cancer patients. Yeah, indeed.
Well, it's fantastic because, of course, it's a very bad situation once somebody's reached that stage of treatment with ovarian cancer.
Yes, indeed, indeed.
So a lot of our listeners are non-scientific, and I'm non-scientific, so please bear with me if I sort of butt in every now and then and ask you to explain the scientific details and the acronyms that you scientists take them for granted. But
yes, of course. I'll try to do it as non-medical as possible. Yeah,
brilliant.
Of course.
So I'd like to just start out, if you don't mind, by asking you a little bit about your background. Could you tell us what took you into the field of research and how your career has led you up to doing this particular and rather unusual trial?
Yes, well, I'm a medical doctor and I just finished my PhD in circulating tumor DNA. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't in this trial from the very beginning. That was the research team I'm in that started this trial, and they're very interested in this tocotrienol treatment across diseases, across cancer diseases. So I was in this trial from the halfway through the trial because of my expertise in circulating tumor DNA, which we also measured in this trial, the HOXA9 methylated circulating tumor DNA to monitor the benefit of treatment in this trial. So that's my background. I'm a doctor.
Right. Yeah. We're straight into the science there. So just tell me why, you know, what exactly you're monitoring there. What are you measuring and why?
We monitored the circulating tumor DNA, which is DNA released from tumor cells. Mm-hmm. So it's very specific. So if you have a cancer, you probably have circulating tumor DNA in your blood. And we try to measure that during the treatment. So every time the patients received treatment, we took a blood sample to monitor the tumor DNA and see how it went up or down during the treatment.
Mm. Okay, so from a patient perspective, I've heard of circulating tumor cell tests, which is a count, I think, of literally counting how many cells there are. Is this the same thing or something different?
Well, it's similar, but usually we don't find as many cells, so around 0 to 10 cells, and they need to have a lot of tumor cells to tumor burden to release tumor cells. So it's the similar way, but you just measure the tumor DNA, so small bits of DNA released from the tumor, and it's a lot easier to find in the blood. So it's kind of same analysis or same thing to measure, but a lot easier to perform and a lot easier to see in a lot more patients than circulating tumor cells.
Okay, all right. So can we go a bit more now into the detail of the trial? So firstly, what exactly is dalcotocotrienol and why did you select this particular thing to trial in this way?
Well, the dalcotocotrienol is it's a part of tocotrienol, which is an analog of vitamin E. So it is it's a substance that is very promising in the cancer treatment. It's got a lot of biological effects in cancer treatment, such as the anti-angionetic effects. So it affects the vessels providing blood to the tumor. So it kind of blocks the fuel for the car. That's one of the things that we think it does. It also, the research community thinks that it also do chemosensitization. So it affects the tumors to be more sensitive to chemotherapy. And well, it got a lot of very promising effects on the cancer diseases. So, and we chose this particular substance because a long way back, there is a connection from the owners of this company that provides the pills and our research team, and they provided the pills for free. And we own the data, and we own everything that we do with this. But we we have these pills, and then we wanted to try on. And a lot of studies have confirmed that the safety and the tolerability of the tocotrienol. So we wanted to try it in real life patients.
Okay, so talking about the live patients then, what were the criteria you used for your trial subjects in terms of their disease and their stage?
Well, it needed to be women with ovarian cancer, and it needed to be women that were disseminated. So their cancers had to be spread out more than the ovarian or the fallopian tube. Okay. So it had to be spread to the lymph nodes or the organs in the body. So very ill women. Yeah.
Right. And what made you particularly want to select advanced ovarian cases like this?
That was because our center was selected by the National Board of Health in Denmark to treat these advanced ovarian cancer women. So around Denmark, in this period of time, it was our center to treat these women with experimental treatments. Right. So it was.
So this is kind of like a central policy for particular places to actually look at one particular disease and see what they can do to improve treatment.
Exactly. Yes.
Sounds good. Yeah. So these centres that are doing this, though, what are these university centres or what?
Not necessarily, no. No. Centres with a long and good history of treating these diseases were selected for different diseases. We're not that many centres in Denmark, so.
Right. So these are just hospital centres then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it could be university centres as well, but ours just became a university centre this year. So back in 2015, when this trial started, we weren't a university centre.
So this is government policy, basically?
Yeah.
Sounds really good. Like it. Okay. So about the trial itself then, what were the methods, what were the steps you took, and what were you looking to measure?
Well, this was a phase two trial, so a trial where you try to see how this substance will benefit real life patients. So we don't know what to expect from effects or toxicity. That's what you measure, but it's the first trial where you give it to real life patients. That's the phase 2 trial.
Okay.
And then we did this Simon 2-stage test. So we started to include 14 patients, looked at the data, and if that was promising enough, we continued to the overall 23 patients.
Mm-hmm. So could I just ask what is a phase 2? So what kind of trials were done leading up to this then?
Well, usually it's a phase 1 trial, it leads up to a phase 2 trial. So phase 1 trial, you either treat patients where you have no idea what dose to give them, you have no idea what to expect from toxicity and benefits of treatment, or it could be healthy individuals, healthy volunteers who receive escalating doses of treatment. And then phase 2, you go into real-life patients, you have a set dose, and then you see what is the benefit of this. And you measure the toxicity as well.
Mm. So in terms of the dose, was it markedly high at all, or you know, how does it fall? Say within the range of what would normally be recommended to someone as a supplement.
Yes.
How does the dose compare?
I don't know how it would compare to the healthy population that would substitute with vitamin E. Mm-hmm. I guess it's a lot higher than that because it's 900 milligrams per day, and that's a high dose.
Right.
So phase 1 trials have gone a lot higher as well, but this is what was tolerable and where we expected to find benefits.
Yeah, okay. And about the outcomes you were measuring, what particular things were you looking for?
Well, of course, we wanted to measure survival. How does this affect survival and progression-free survival?
Mm-hmm.
But also, because it's a new treatment, it's very important to look at the quality of life as well. So is this actually beneficial for the patients in regard of survival? It must be balanced with the quality of life. It doesn't make any sense to, well, in our opinion at least, to prolong life, but then you have absolutely none quality of life or yeah. non-existent. So,
well,
so that was what we were measuring.
Yeah. Well, that's a good new focus, if you like. I mean, yeah, as you kind of hinted at, in the past, a lot of treatments may have given some survival advantage, but the extra life
yeah.
was actually terribly low quality and barely worth
yeah.
having. So, yeah, very important to measure both. One phrase used there, which is progression-free survival, for this is another way that doctors talk about this is stable disease, isn't it? So this is kind of like saying
yeah.
that it's managed to maintain a period of time when the disease has not actually spread at all.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
Very good. All right. So let's get the results now. So what actually happened?
Well, we looked at the survival and found, compared to the literature, that we prolonged survival a fair bit. We had, if you look at the literature, you have around overall survival and progression-free survival of overall survival 5 to 7 months and progression-free survival of 2 to 4 months. It's a very, it's a population of very ill women. And we
yes.
prolonged this to overall survival of 10 months and progression-free survival of 7 months. And we found that 20% of the patient received more than a year of treatment. And that was very positive. That's a very promising result
right.
in this group of patients.
Yeah, so that's a huge gain. I mean, you know, if this was a drug, you know, you'd have heard about it all over the headlines by now.
Yeah.
So very exciting. Can we just talk a bit about, so there's the survival advantage. Now, you also said, yeah, you're looking for how it affected their quality of life as well. So what about that area? What did you find there?
Well, we found that it didn't negatively affect their quality of life. They mm-hmm. had the same quality of life when they started out in this trial as in after receiving treatment. And then the quality of life decreased progression as expected. So so when the disease is not under control anymore, your quality of life will decrease because of pain, weakness, tiredness, and these kind of things. But during treatment, we didn't see any effect on quality of life, which was very, very positive.
Yeah. So you were a kind of what people are looking for, obviously, when they do a trial is that obviously they're not trying to cause any harm. They're not trying to reduce the quality of life. Did you have any reason to suspect that the quality of life, well, obviously the fact it was longer meant it was improved inherently, but did you think it improved the quality of life generally in any way, or did you suspect that?
No, we didn't suspect that. We suspected that it would, because previous studies have shown that it's safe and very good tolerability, we didn't expect to find any toxicity or any decreasing quality of life measurements, but we measured it to see if that was correct, and in our opinion, that was correct. But we need to take in mind that it's only 23 patients, so
yes,
it is limited.
Small number.
Small number of patients.
So this kind of trial, as a particular trial type, it's called what? I mean, this is not a randomized controlled trial. It's what's the title for this trial?
We call it non-randomized trial, the phase 2 trial.
Right, a non-randomized. And so with this, you're actually comparing what you would expect given the overall statistics of survival for this particular condition with what you got amongst your patients.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So you compare it to the literature,
So in evidence terms, this is not as highly esteemed as a randomized trial, but nonetheless, this is something to take notice of.
It is indeed something to take notice of, and it is something to work on, to do trials in the future, randomized trials with larger samples of patients. So this is hypothesis generating, whatever you call it. But to see, especially when new treatments are tested, you need to see in a small population, are there anything in this? Do you need to go further on with more trials in this? And this looks very promising. So,
And the good news about this particular one, as a sort of natural, if you like, intervention, is that it can, because it's a single substance, it can actually be trialed in the same way as a drug. You can do a randomized trial with it quite easily.
Yes.
Yeah.
Quite easily, yeah.
Okay, so you've already mentioned one of the things that is quite, it's often associated with the addition of one of these sort of natural approaches I've noticed, is that it can bring a resensitizing of the cancer to a treatment that is previously become resistant to. This is, you mentioned this because it's already been noted in the literature before. Is this something you were involved with at all during this trial?
Well, we saw that 50% of the patient had previously been exposed to bevacizumab as they received in this trial as well. So it could look like it could resensitize to tocotrienol. But we saw that it was actually spread out, so there were no association to previous treatment with bevacizumab. Can you say that?
Whether they'd had treatment before didn't necessarily make any difference to their survival in this particular trial.
No, exactly.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Not exactly. Yeah.
And just to be clear, the rather obscure name that you used, the public will know it by its trade name of Avastin.
Avastin,
which is quite a common drug, of course. So the integrative medicine is a term that's now widely used to describe a kind of broad, inclusive approach that combines both standard treatment, orthodox medicine, and some of the complementary alternative medicines. It's quite interesting how I've noticed that quite often when one single intervention, such as the one you've used, is added to a standard treatment, the effects can be quite startling, both in terms of the quality of life, as you mentioned, and the life extension. Some clinics are actually capitalising on this, of course, and they're actually quite deliberately sort of bringing things together to get this kind of synergistic result. So Do you think that this approach of introducing natural agents alongside drugs warrants further attention?
Well, yes, but you need to do it with caution. It needs to be evidence-based. You can't just combine different sorts of natural medicine and orthodox medicine. You can't just combine that without having evidence of not harming the patients. Right. That's the biggest thing. You're not allowed to harm the patients even more than they already are with the cancer disease. So, but yes, I see a lot of new trials and a lot of new combinations now and in the future, definitely.
Mm. Yeah. So, I mean, I one of my programs recently focused on some trials that had been on adding vitamin C to standard treatment, and they achieved very similar results to you. With a game of advanced aggressive cancers to actually double life expectancy. And they noted also improvements in quality of life. So very striking results for a kind of cheap, safe, simple intervention.
Exactly, yeah. Mm.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about where this might take us. I know in the UK here, the fact that you've achieved this result is not going to cause a lot of excitement over here, unfortunately. I think it should. Well, it definitely should, because this is an enormous win for people with ovarian cancer. It's something, I mean, I don't know if you got to hear in Denmark, but there was a campaign a little while ago in the UK to change the law by Lord Saatchi, because he described his wife's treatment for ovarian cancer as endlessly repeating a failed experiment, which actually hit the nail on the head. They know it doesn't work, but it's what they do. You know, it's the best they've got. And there's no kind of initiative like the one you've described in Denmark right now, which is brilliant, where they're actually saying, well, OK, that's what we got. Can we make it any better? In Denmark and Europe, what kind of effect do you think the trial that you've just concluded is likely to have? Is it likely to have effects beyond the walls of where you're doing this research?
Well, it's hard to tell, but I definitely think that it would hopefully spread out to at least inside Denmark, because we're small centers and we're small oncology community, so we talk to each other and tell each other about these findings. So hopefully it will spread out over Denmark at least. But it is usually something that takes time and takes, unfortunately, years to implement and to spread these good news. But hopefully this is the first step in introducing hopefully new and better treatment in these ovarian cancer women.
And do you get to present the results of your trial in other countries?
We submitted it to some different meetings. I don't think it's been selected yet for talks, but for posters at least, so that we can present the research in different countries, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so we try to spread out the news.
Yeah, well, I think it's very important. I mean, you know, without a government initiative, as you have in Denmark, this kind of trial... Mm. It seems to me it's unlikely to ever happen, because the only driver for the direction of science in the main is money, you know, and of course this is not going to lead to anybody's profits, adding vitamin E to treatment. And so, you know, if the level of interest is entirely based on whether it's going to be profitable or not, well, you know, it'll always be sidelined. So hence the huge importance of the government in Denmark getting behind this kind of thing, because ours hasn't done this yet. There's no government intervention to say, oh yeah, we should look into some of these things, which nobody else will do. I'm just very interested in how that came about in Denmark. Do you know anything about what drove that initiative in the first place?
No, I don't actually. Sorry, I don't know anything about that. But it's, well, the... The health in Denmark is free, so you don't pay for your treatment as a patient, and in that way, the cheaper treatment, the better for the government. So I guess vitamin E analogs are a lot cheaper than whatever is intervened as, or whatever chemotherapy new chemotherapy is very expensive. So I guess these tocotrienol is a lot cheaper. Mm. So in that way, there's a lot of...
good reasons, a good motive to do it.
Yeah,
well, that doesn't seem to play out in this country, unfortunately. That's common sense. But over here, they still seem to go for the new, the hyped up, the really expensive drugs. You know, they're always arguing about those, whether to allow them in or not. Because we have a similar healthcare system, of course. One of the exciting things that's happening at the moment is actually a sort of spin-off from a crisis, a financial crisis in the health service, which is, this has resulted in, of course, which is they are actually running out of money. So there is a movement to look outside the box, but it hasn't really come into the territory of cancer yet. It's happening in general health and an initiative to keep people out of hospital, if you like, and care for them in the community and keep them well, which is brilliant. But we're still a way off seeing initiatives in cancer, which could save lots of money, I think. You know, there are quite a lot of them. Mm. Okay, so
I think it's difficult to get the politicians to say anything about saving money in cancer treatments. I think that's the same in Denmark, actually.
Yeah, no, it's true. Yeah. The two things just don't go together, do they?
No.
Yeah. So I'm very interested in the implications of your findings for people with other cancers. Do you anticipate that this affects kind of limited to the cancer that you chose for the trial? Have you got reasons to think it's got much wider implications for a whole range?
Well, we think it's got effect in other cancers as well, in other cancer types as well, because of in the literature, it's described as general effect on angiogenesis and the chemosensitization. So we just finished a trial with together with chemotherapy and tocotrienol in metastatic colorectal cancer, and we're looking into data on that one now. And we're setting up a trial in colorectal cancer as well, where we combined it with chemotherapy and Avastin and tocotrienol. So we're very much looking into this result and try to see if it has the same effect in other cancer types as well. So yeah, we're very keen on going into research with this very promising result from ovarian cancer, definitely.
So what are your thinking so far on the mechanism here? Is it seems like, I mean, obviously both those things, the Avastin and the Delta Tocotrienol, have their own effects. But the results of them together seems to be a lot better than you'd expect. Do you have any thoughts about the mechanism of the synergy between these two things?
No, I don't. I don't know if anyone else described the synergy, but affecting the vessels, both of them affecting the
blood vessels,
the building of vessels for the tumor, and I think that's the synergy in it, of it. But the further mechanism, I don't know, unfortunately.
Mm. So because they're both targeting this one very important mechanism of that cancers use to attract the fuel they need, you think it's improved the performance enormously? Yeah. So that mechanism, of course, is common to all solid tumors.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so
they all need vessels and blood.
Mm. Yeah, so that would be a reason to think that the Delta Tocotrienol would be a great addition to any other anti-angiogenic treatment for any other solid cancer.
Exactly. Mm. But also the chemosensitization. So if you use chemotherapy and tocotrienol, you might get this synergetic effect. Where they have reached an even better effect. Adding tocotrienol.
That's interesting. So maybe you could just say a bit about how you understand that works. How does the Delta Tocotrienol resensitize cancers in this way? What's that going on? How does it actually make cancers vulnerable to a treatment, or more vulnerable?
Well, they increase the apoptotic rate, you make it more sensible for apoptosis. You make the cells more sensible for apoptosis, so that when the chemotherapy reaches the cancer cells, they die immediately.
I see. So it basically makes them more like a healthy cell in that way than you're saying. Because healthy cells actually, they go through the cycle of apoptosis, which is cell death, quite naturally. But the cancer cells don't do it. That's obviously the defining thing about cancer cells. They don't normally do this.
Not exactly, they just grow.
Yeah, so the vitamin E extract is actually making them more healthy in a way, more like a healthy cell.
Yeah, you can say that.
So again, that is something that's very widely useful because that again is one of the things that's common to all cancers. That's even, they don't even have to be solid tumours for that to be true. Am I right?
No, not necessarily.
So all cancer cells, they have their apoptosis is not functioning properly. So if you gave vitamin E, there are reasons to suppose that it would improve any treatment that you were having to try and kill those cells.
Well, hopefully. You need to take caution of course. 23 patients, but yes, hopefully. Yeah.
But I mean, I'm saying that there's, because you've taken an idea here of what might happen with vitamin E and you've tried it out and it actually worked, then there are reasons to think that it may work in a huge range of other situations then.
Yes.
Well, that's pretty exciting and pretty huge as well, isn't it? For, you know, there's a lot of people with cancer would be interested to know that.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so can we talk a little bit about where you're heading with your program, what you're thinking about in terms of what you might research? You've already said some trials are underway now. Have you got a bit of a plan for the future of where you think you want to go with this?
Well, as I said, definitely we want to go further in colorectal cancer, metastatic colorectal cancer, with these two trials, the one I'm setting up and one that's just finished. But it's hard to tell. We're a small research center, so we need to focus on different trials at different times. But definitely it looks very interesting in these ovarian cancer women. So I think that's one of the next steps we need to take care of and follow this very promising result to the door. But if we are a small center, and in that sentence, we can perform a lot of new research, but with unfortunately small samples of patients. So we see ourselves as doing the first work, and then we hope for other centers to follow, where a lot of more patients can be randomized and these results can be confirmed, hopefully.
Yeah, well, that's important. I can see, yes, you're obviously performing in the area that you can best because of the size of your organisation and clearly doing very valuable work, actually producing hopeful results, you know, that are worth pursuing. You kind of need partnering up. I mean, this is where another government initiative would be good, wouldn't it? To actually say, right, OK, the interesting stuff that comes out of here, we need to then delegate that to some much larger organisation that's capable of trialling it further. I mean, interestingly, there's a lot of talk in the UK about real-world data, which is a very promising phrase that I like a lot, which is means sort of getting away, if you like, from the world of the terribly carefully selected groups of patients for these trials that are really trying to generate a good result, if you like, to a situation where you have a more general spread of patients, you know, with maybe with more than one condition, more like what actually happens, and trialing something on a very large number of them, which of course our health service and probably yours as well has the capability to do, really, because they're dealing with those people. But they're just not collecting the data. And it's kind of like, it's nuts from our point of view. Why rely on the data coming from companies who are trying to produce a successful drug and not just do the work yourself in your own hospitals by seeing what happens? So an intervention like the one that you've been trialing, though, is unusual in as much as, of course, in terms of safety, it's in a completely different league to testing Avastin, for example, which is, you know, a drug that could potentially produce a lot of bad effects. So you know, everybody knows that vitamin E is enormously safe. It's only a matter of getting the dosage right. So the potential for testing that on a huge number of people quite quickly and easily and comparing it with ones who didn't get it or who thought they got it is, it's not a big deal by trial standards, is it?
No, not at all. And that's what we did with this trial in colorectal cancer that just finished. So yes. Half of them got the tocotrienol and half of them just got pills with, calcium pills?
Yeah? Calcium pills, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, just placebo. Yeah.
Well, good.
It's very easy to perform. Very easy.
So you've done a small randomized trial then in that case. So how many people are involved in that?
75. We just included the last one a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. So right. Now we need to see and to open up the data to see what patient got which treatment and then compare the data.
Right. Interesting. When do you expect to have some results from that?
Hopefully in a couple of months. Right. That's another PhD student that needs to look into that, and she starts a PhD in a month and a half, I think.
Right. Yeah. What's the period, the length of the whole trial, say that the one you've done with the vitamin E extract? How long has it taken?
Yeah, that was a bit less than 3 years.
Right.
So.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not many patients in a long period of time.
Yeah, but nonetheless, if that was picked up now and extrapolated as being a very promising result, which is what it looks like to me, to a larger number of people, within maybe a total of 5 years, you could have come up with something which is clearly a winner. You know, which is like, in the scale of things, is pretty fast, unfortunately.
Definitely.
So, I think it's really important that, these initiatives are not just bypassed. That would be the danger in this country. So I hope Denmark is going to do the right thing here and pick up on your amazing results.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Is there anything that your organisation can do to promote a larger trial, or do you have to sit and wait and hope?
It's difficult to promote trials. I don't think we're allowed to do that, but we could always, when we do trials, invite other centers to participate. Mm-hmm. To like this initiative back in 2015, where you invite all ovarian cancer women from all over the country, you can definitely try to do that again. Some of the patients are too ill to travel or don't want to travel, but usually they're very keen on getting the most promising treatment.
Yes.
So it's definitely worth putting up trials and then inviting all suitable patients from all over the different centers, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. So that basically raises awareness of what you're doing.
Yeah, that would definitely work. Yeah.
All right. Well, look, I was wanting to talk to you as soon as I read about the results of your trial, because I just thought, blimey, this is the kind of thing that people need to know about. You know, it's just really important. I really hope that the whole thing is picked up and it does go much wider and becomes available to many more people, assuming that is, of course, that it comes up with the results when larger numbers are used, which, no reason to suppose it won't at this point. That would be just fantastic and is, of course, enormously needed by, first of all, that group of women with advanced ovarian cancer, which is a horrendous situation, but it seems like it could be far, far more than just that as well.
Yeah, definitely. And the good thing about these women as well, that we don't have any treatment for them, and they are usually in very good performance status. So they're actually capable of receiving this treatment from the very beginning. And so this is a very good group that probably could benefit a lot from this treatment. So hopefully.
And that's because of the nature of ovarian cancer, that it actually, the effects of it don't come till very late on. And so people are very often not diagnosed until it's already very advanced.
Exactly. Yeah. And then it progresses very fast.
Very fast and very aggressively, yes. Okay. Well, look, we're going to leave it there. It's been extremely interesting. Thank you very much indeed, Caroline, for talking to us about it. And, you know, I wish you the very best with the ongoing work.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Well, I think that's such an important finding. If medicine really was for people's health rather than mainly for profit, then it would create a storm of activity, finding out just how stable those results are and how many other situations the findings can be applied to. You can find links to material related to today's interview on the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk. Click the show logo that's on the homepage. I'd like to tell you about an event later this month. Yes to Life has a wellness day at Manchester Art Gallery on the 27th of April, in which nutritionist and coach Liz Butler, exercise cancer specialist Lizzie Davis, mindfulness expert Claire McCluskey, and nutritionist Sylvia Grazendi will be leading a day brimming with ideas for staying as well as possible throughout cancer and cancer treatment. If you can possibly get to this event, be sure to get yourself a place. Book either from the Yes to Life Facebook page or from the events page on the Yes to Life website. Again, that's yestolife.org.uk. Great to have you join me for today's show. Please make a point of listening again next week. Goodbye.